Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the History of Witchcraft. Episode 27, A Wonderful Discovery. The two degrees of persons which chiefly practice witchcraft are such as are in great misery and poverty, for such the devil allures to follow him by promising great riches and worldly commodities. Others, though rich, yet burn in a desperate desire of revenge. He allures them by promises to get their turn satisfied to their heart's contentment. Thomas Potts, in The Wonderful Discovery of Witches in the County of Lancaster. She never hurt anybody, but did help divers persons that were stricken or forespoken, and that her spirit came weakly to her, and would tell of divers persons that were stricken and forespoken. And she saith that the use which she had of the spirit was to know those did which she had undertaken to amend, and she did help them by certain prayers which she used. The testimony of Joan Willamette, defending her use of a familiar in 1619. Welcome back to the History of Witchcraft podcast. Last week we heard about the changing attitude of James towards his supernatural enemy, and that arc will continue today. There is a noticeable difference in the court view of witchcraft and within the legal profession, which we can examine through the reactions to the trials that dotted his reign and those of his son and heir, Charles. We left off last week as 10 people, 9 of them women, hanged on Lancaster Moor on a breezy August Monday in 1612. They had been imprisoned in the dungeons of Lancaster Castle for almost 4 months, awaiting trials which took less than a day. Today, we'll return to Lancashire and see the fallout from these events and how those responsible for the convictions sought to protect and improve their careers. Because even with witchcraft being a capital crime, the execution of so many in such a short space of time was unusual. In modern parlance, the optics were bad, especially with a king on the throne who had contradicted his own reputation by pursuing fraudulent witchcraft convictions. The most effective way to manage the public reaction was to control the story. And for that, the judges, Bromley and Altham, commissioned the clerk of the Assizes, Thomas Potts, to transform his trial notes into a pamphlet. Intended to justify their actions, the wonderful discovery of witches in the county of Lancaster meant that these trials were the most famous of their kind in England for decades, possibly until the time of the Witchfinder General. But the events that I covered last week were not the only trials conducted by Bromley and Altham. Indeed, simultaneously with the Pendle Trials, which was the name given for last week's case, as many of those convicted came from the Pendle region of Lancashire, a case was built against 8 people based on the testimony of a young child, 14-year-old Grace Sowerbutts. Sowerbutts told the JPs, and later Bromley, that the accused had murdered a toddler and then eaten it, physically abused her, tried to make her commit suicide, and taking her to a sabbat where she danced, ate, and had sex with 4 demons. In the face of this graphic testimony, Bromley threw the case out. 5 of the 8 accused were immediately released without trial upon his arrival, while the other 3 were acquitted after Sowerbutts admitted that she'd invented the claims. Dr. Robert Poole, in his Lancashire Witches, Histories and Stories, suggests that the Lancaster trials of 1612 can show us the differing ideas of what constituted witchcraft to peasants and to judicial officials. The Pendle trials that led to the deaths of Chattox and the Devices were centred on the action of Maleficium, as described in the 1604 Act. Whereas Sauerbutz's claims of transforming into animals and the cannibalism of infants were extraordinary and grounded in superstition, and so Bromley's scepticism was recognisable by his contemporaries as sensible. But where could a young girl learn these ridiculous superstitions? Of course, it was the papists. Quote, "The wench had nothing to say, but her master told nothing of this. In the end, some that were present told his lordship the truth, and the prisoners informed him how she went to learn with one Thompson, a seminary priest, who had instructed and taught her this accusation against them, because they were once obstinate papists and now came to church. Here is the discovery of this priest and of his whole practice." In other words, a local Jesuit priest was angry at a number of former Catholics who had begun to attend Anglican services and convinced Sauerbutz to make her accusations to punish them. The account of the Salisbury trial, as it came to be known based on the origins of the accused, is a helpful contrast to the Pendle trial. With this, Potts shows that not only are his patrons reasonable and appropriately sceptical, thereby implying that the Pendle convictions were not a case of overzealousness, but also scoring political points by taking shots at the ever-present bogeyman of the Jesuits. This is only one of the checkboxes that Potts made sure to tick in The Wonderful Discovery. The 1612 trials were highly controversial, not just in Lancashire itself, but more worryingly for the judges themselves, in London and in the court of James. James had, after all, shown a remarkable scepticism towards English witch trials. The judges were working to enforce the king's peace, his peace. The problem was, as confusing as the king's attitude and beliefs towards witchcraft are to us today, with the benefit of hindsight and a range of sources, it would have been possibly more confusing for his subjects. In Jacobean England, the travelling judges were briefed on the intended policies of Whitehall before they were dispatched to their designated jurisdictions. This was so that the essential policy could be communicated to the provinces. Now, whether or not witchcraft was specifically mentioned to the Lancaster judges, none can say, there's no record. However, where James was inconsistent on witchcraft, he was very clear on religious conformity, and so it's likely that a crackdown on heresy was part of the judge's royal charge. It is also entirely possible that Bromley and Eltham were as contemptuous of superstitious, popish, backwards Lancashire as any other sophisticated Londoner. Sorry, Lancaster. However, even with a charge to crack down on heresy, or even explicitly to root out witchcraft as per the 1604 Act, in the words of Pumphrey, to be the first judge to hang a coven of people accused of making diabolic compacts was a risky career move. With this risky career move done, and word of the mass execution filtering through the country, let's take a look at how The Wonderful Discovery depicts the events. We'll start with Alice Nutter. Nutter was the only suspect noted as being wealthy. Potts describes her as, quote, "a rich woman, had a great estate, and children of good hope. In the common opinion of the world, of good temper, free from envy or malice," end quote. Nutter was not among the expected subjects in an English witch trial. By far the most common sort of people facing trial for Maleficium were just that, the common sort. Poor and vulnerable members of the community, often widows, usually accrued reputations for both spitefulness and magical ability. Eventually, some kind of social strife would trigger an accusation, and the weight of this reputation would hang around the neck of the accused until it was followed by a pillory, or a rope. So when there were exceptions to this rule, it aroused special interest and greater scepticism from the public. Potts seems to be aware of this danger, and so takes the time to defend the actions of his patrons. Quote, "Great was the care and pains of his lordship to make trial of the innocence of this woman. As shall appear unto you upon the examination of Jennet Device in open court at the time of her arraignment and trial, by an extraordinary means of trial, to mark her out from the rest. Here, Potts expresses the lengths to which Bromley and Altham went to assure that even this seemingly upstanding member of society was guilty. The judges arranged an identity parade and brought in Nutter's accuser, the young Jennet Device, who pointed out Nutter from the row. Bromley then gave Jennet a false name, only for the girl to decline to accuse the fake-named woman. This frankly bizarre charade is held up as a counter to the Salisbury trials and the fake Salbert's accusations for, quote, "This could be no forged or false accusation, but the very act of God to discover her." Stephen Pumphrey and Marion Gibson both thoroughly dissect the wonderful discovery in their chapters of Poole's Lancashire Witches. Thomas Potts was the clerk of the Assizes, an irreplaceable part of the official judicial system, but he was far from neutral, and he was not interested in presenting a balanced or even particularly accurate account of the trial. His job was to craft a narrative that would both appeal to readers as well as portray the trials of the August Lancashire Assizes in a positive light. To this end, Potts rearranged the order that evidence and testimony was given, ignored important aspects of legal procedure, portrayed written affidavits as spoken testimony, and edited the speeches of the judges to improve their readability. It isn't that the discovery was fantastical or ill-intended. Rather it is, in the words of Gibson, an account obviously published to display the shining efficiency and justice of the legal system. Potts repeatedly recounts how the defendants made use of image magic. If you recall, image magic had been a staple of Elizabethan witch fears for decades, where an effigy or tablet with the name of the target was damaged or otherwise soiled, in order to cause the subject physical or mental ailments. The text also depicts a trial where witch sabbats made their first appearance in English courts, but Malcolm Gaskill argues that this owes more to the wonderful discovery seeking to appeal to the authority of James, both legal and demonological, than anything to do with the defendants themselves. The wonderful discovery is remarkable in the way that it emulates James's demonology to a T, and this is certainly deliberate. It transformed the witches from localised maleficium-wielding terrors of the community to sabbat-attending, diabolic servants more in line with continental theories and those published in James's demonology. This had the effect of not only pandering to James's own writings, but also escalating the threat posed by the witches and going some way to justify their mass hanging. Pumphrey also compares the arguments found in both James's treatises and in the discovery, and he finds five or six parallels that were almost certainly deliberately intended. The first was James's division of witches into the rich and poor, who the devil tempted in different ways. We alluded to these differences earlier with Nutter, where the rich were convinced to serve the devil for more malicious reasons like revenge or spite, while the poor are promised worldly riches. I read out an excerpt from the discovery at the beginning of the episode, where Potts describes the different motivations with, funnily enough, almost the exact same words as James did in the demonology. What a coincidence. The second ripoff, I mean element of the trial that was inspired by King James's illuminating treatise, was how the devil revealed himself to his future servants. Demonology described three stages. First, the devil appears as a disembodied voice or as a normal person when the target is alone. The next time, the devil concludes his pact and places, quote, his mark upon some secret place of their body, and at the third meeting he starts to fulfil his part of the bargain. Lo and behold, the four confessions of Demdike, Chattox, James and Alison all fit this pattern very closely. In Pumphrey's words, this is extraordinary given that diabolism and pacts were not a part of Pendle popular beliefs. That isn't my sarcasm, that's Pumphrey's. The third is found in the treatment of sabbats. Now, sabbats were a central aspect of elite demonological theory, and it is likely that elements of this highbrow theology made its way into the popular discourse. The problem was, as James argued, since only witches were in attendance at a sabbat, only witches could give evidence about it. Conveniently enough, the Malkin Tower Sabbat was a central part of James Device's testimony, at which point Potts quotes word for word from the demonology. Here, Potts returns to the testimony of Sourbuds, which told of baby eating, sexual abuse, and night flying. This was the testimony thrown out by Bromley and Altham for being too ridiculous, which is itself an element borrowed from both demonology and the greater mass of demonological works. The powers of the devil and his servants had limits, and they were not able to break the laws of nature. Mirabilia, or wonders, were possible, but miracula, or miracles, were only possible by the power of God. At least, that was the opinion of James, so it was the opinion of his judges. The fourth parallel we've already covered, image magic, and the use of wax and clay dolls of the victim. This was the Pendle Witch's method of choice. According to the discovery, Old Demdike described her methods in a way that was, in the words of Pumphrey, very reminiscent of the demonology. The fifth parallel was of the extraordinary legal measures that were justified in being brought to bear in witchcraft trials. The crime itself was so heinous that otherwise unacceptable or questionable methods could be used to secure a conviction. The use of testimony from children and other suspects, the dunking of witches, and godly miracles. James argued in demonology that, in the case of murder through magic, if the murderer touched the corpse, then it would bleed fresh blood. The Lancaster witches were not dunked, but Potts does recall that the said Janet Preston, coming to touch the dead corpses, they bled fresh blood presently, in the presence of all that there were present, which hath ever been held a great argument to induce a jury to hold him guilty that shall be accused of murder.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The sixth parallel, which we've already touched on, was the skepticism shown by the judges in the Salisbury cases. Even in demonology, James warned against judicial credulity. Potts repeatedly reminds the reader that Bromley and Altham had already shown that they could be skeptical. There's no way they could have gotten in over their heads in Pendle. They threw the Salisbury case out for being too ridiculous. Salisbury is an interesting case for more than that reason. It showed that Potts, and the judges guiding his work, were aware of all the worries preoccupying James. Not just witches, but also Catholic plotters. Salisbury had fraudulent witchcraft accusations, but these were caused by those naughty papists. Effectively, the wonderful discovery showed that Lancashire was indeed the heartland of superstition Londoners believed it to be, but it had been purged of many of the satanic and Roman plotters infesting it. Before we leave the 1612 trials and the wonderful discovery, we should take a look at the role of Baron Thomas Knyvett. Now, who was Knyvett, you're asking? Well, Knyvett was a courtier of James, and one of the agents who physically arrested Guy Fawkes. Naturally, this made him the apple of the king's eye, and he was awarded with titles and gifts, the greatest perhaps being the Warden of the Mint. Rather than being in charge of the King's Mentos, he was of course one of the chief financial officers of the realm. But remember back a couple of episodes where we discussed James's reign? He was cash-strapped due to refusing to regularly call a parliament, so Knyvett had the unenviable job of trying to find an ample source of money for his king. Worse still, in 1612, his patron, the Earl of Salisbury, died. This was just terrible news. Court politics required a network of alliances to keep in favour, and Knyvett had just lost his greatest one. So what does any of this have to do with Potts? Well, Potts was a client of Knyvett, and undoubtedly the Baron found a way to boost his position in the pen of his man. Even if he played no role in the actual writing of the discovery, he could claim a certain amount of credit for a highly publicised work which vindicated James's own teachings in his demonology. Lancaster had played host to a trial that was an almost perfect replication of what the king had warned of in 1597. But what makes Pomfrey and myself believe Knyvett was more involved in the pamphlet than he might claim were the details of the Malkin Tower Sabbat. If you recall, this was the meeting where the witches at Liberty discussed their plan to detonate a hoard of gunpowder to demolish the walls of Lancaster Castle where their comrades were being held and stage a jailbreak. Gunpowder. That seems somewhat familiar. It reminds me of some sort of plot. Could it be, perhaps, that Knyvett had Potts insert this little detail to remind the king of his own brush with gunpowder that was in part foiled by Knyvett? Now, this is a stretch, and Pomfrey admits it is to be so. Quote, "The extent to which the wonderful discovery was a deliberate patronage ploy for turning potentially metropolitan scepticism into royal favour remains conjectural." End quote. But one has to wonder, if this was an organic confession, or even less likely, a genuine plan to use gunpowder, where would the witches have gotten it from? It was a highly controlled substance that took the gunpowder plotters many weeks to accumulate, and that was in the trading hub of London. Once they got this gunpowder, how exactly would they get it into and against the castle? They'd need quite a bit too. Lancaster Castle is, after all, a castle. It's in the name. It's designed to be tough. No, Pomfrey concludes that it's much more reasonable that this scheme was either invented whole cloth by Noel and agreed to by a desperate James Device, or otherwise embellished by Potts. So, what happened with Brumley and Altham? Were their propaganda efforts successful, their reputations enhanced and their careers advanced, or were the sceptical crowds of London enough to drown them in the king's displeasure? Well, the answer is, nothing much happened. They weren't significantly promoted, but neither were they demoted. It was a controversial and somewhat embarrassing event, but was otherwise ignored. So as we leave 1612 behind, we leave a demonological world where the familiar, rather than the devil, was still paramount in folkloric conceptions of witchcraft, although times are changing, as we will see. Although, we're hardly travelling far into the future here, only a year, to 1613. The Witches of Bever, which is spelt Belvoir, but which apparently was too Norman for the Anglo-Saxon locals to pronounce as such, is in the county of Leicester. In 1613, three folk healers, Joan, Margaret, and Philippa Flowers, were employed as servants in Bever Castle for a visit of King James. However, the Flowers were not popular, and faced accusations of theft, leading to all three being dismissed. Shortly after their dismissal, the Earl of Rutland and his wife, the Countess, fell ill, suffering from, quote, "vomiting and convulsions," end quote. The Lord and Lady survived this brush with illness, but their family was not so lucky. Their eldest, but still very young son, Henry, succumbed to the sickness and died, while the illness ravaged their surviving son and daughter. So you may assume that, because of the connection between this family of herbal healers being fired and the inconvenient deaths of the Rutland scion, that the Earl and the Countess immediately lay the blame for his death on the Flowers. And you would be incorrect. It took 5 years, seemingly spurred on by the death of their remaining son, Francis. Just before Christmas 1618, the Flowers were arrested on the order of the Earl of Rutland. After being examined, the Flowers were transferred to Lincoln Jail. En route, it is reported that Joan Flower, the mother of Philip and Margaret, was vocal in pleading her innocence, volunteering all manner of things to prove that she was a good Christian. At one point, she asked for a piece of bread to substitute the Eucharist, where the bread and wine are consumed, either representing the body and blood of Jesus Christ, or actually becoming the body and blood of Jesus Christ, depending on your denomination. Joan argued, with unfortunate vigour, that bread considered to be so holy as to represent the body of Christ could not be eaten by anyone evil, and certainly not a witch. Why was it unfortunate that she argued her case so well? Well, when Joan was given some bread, she choked to death on it. Again, modern language, the optics just weren't good. Once Margaret and Philippa made it to Lincoln, they were questioned about their role in the deaths of the Rutlands. Eventually, both women confessed. They had communed with spirits and familiars who had helped them with their evil works. The mother, the murdered by Carb's Joan Flower, had a familiar in the form of a cat called Rutterkin, who played a central role in their testimony. Joan stole the glove of the Earl of Rutland, who dipped it in water, stroked it along Rutterkin's back, and needled it while chanting incantations. This brought about the illness that claimed the life of Henry, the Earl's heir, but the same could not be done to the Rutland daughter because Rutterkin turned out to have no power over her. The women also confessed to having taken feathers from the bed of the Earl and Countess and cast a spell that prevented them from having any more children. As it happens, after the death of his sons, the Earl would die without an heir, his titles passing to a brother. During their examinations, the Flowers denounced three other women as their accomplices, who were subsequently arrested and themselves examined. The interrogators found their confessions. They all confessed to receiving visions and consorting with spirits, much like the Flowers, although one confessed to using these spirits to murder her enemies. The Flowers were both found guilty of witchcraft and executed at Lincoln Castle in 1619, and the fate of their supposed accomplices is a mystery. The Rutlands remained so convinced that they had been victims of sorcery that it was inscribed on a monument, lamenting the deaths of their, quote, two sons, both of which died in their infancy by wicked practices and sorcery. This is largely a similar story to any we've heard before, with one exception. The confession that the Flowers had cast a spell to stop the Earl of Rutland having any more children with his wife. This isn't on its own particularly unusual. Fertility spells and curses are commonly seen in trials across Europe, but never in England. This is the first time that I've heard of such a claim in an English trial, and it may well be an indication of the extent of the exchange between continental and British demonological thought, as well as between the witch beliefs of the commons and the elite magistrates. In between the death of Henry Manners in 1612 and the trial of his supposed killers in 1618 to 1619, there was another trial of witches in Leicester that is worth covering. Not just because of its body count, which was excessive with 9 witches being hanged, but in its political fallout. On the 16th of July 1616, 9 women were executed at the gallows, based on the accusations of a 12-year-old boy, seemingly called Smith. Details are somewhat scarce, but Smith seems to have blamed these women for a series of afflictions, which made him dance around in public making animal noises. The women were arrested, tried and found guilty by the judges, Sir Randolph Crewe and Sir Humphrey Winch, and sentenced to death. Well, that's all sorted, they may well have thought, patting themselves on the back. Only it wasn't sorted. Not in the slightest. This is, after all, only a few years after the Lancaster trials with their execution of 10 people. That became national talk, and so too did this, to the extent that James himself dropped by a few weeks after the women were cut down from the rope. I don't know whether James had planned to visit Leicester anyway, or if it was specifically for this reason, but while he was in the city, he had the young boy brought to him. Much like with the trial of Anne Gunter, James was interested in proving his scholarly worth, and so he questioned Smith himself. In the words of Francis Osborne, James quickly, quote, discovered a fallacy, end quote. The boy's testimony fell apart, and he admitted that he'd invented his afflictions. Unlike with the Gunter case, James' intervention had not come soon enough. 9 women, innocent women, had been judicially murdered by James's agents, and he was not the least bit amused. The judges were reprimanded for their credulity, and others were warned, again in the words of Osborne, to be circumspect in condemning those committed by ignorant justices for diabolical compacts. To what extent Crewe and Winch were punished is unclear. Crewe was certainly unfazed. He remained welcome at court and kept powerful company. While Winch may have been less fortunate with his career, he still lived another 9 years and died quite well off, so it's unlikely that his reputation was fatally damaged by this blunder. The question is, though, what James would have thought if he'd questioned Jennet Device, the child source of the testimony that took many of the Pendle witches to the gallows. Perhaps he would have agreed with his judges, but I have to expect that, based on his skepticism of child witnesses in both 1605 and 1616, that he would be just as incredulous in 1612. Next time, we will finish with the Devil's greatest enemy as we examine the final trials of his reign and continue into the rule of his son Charles. Charles I is famous for many things, but mostly the way that he misplaced his head from his body in a dispute with Parliament. Thank you to Hammer of the Witches, executed today, Witchfinder General Michelle G, and the Inquisitors Trish G, Elaine D, and to all my theologians for supporting the show through Patreon. You can join their ranks by visiting the show's Patreon page at patreon.com/historyofwitchcraft. The intro and outro music have been provided by Sounds Like an Earful. Thank you again for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.